Welcome to the Athenaeum Review, where we talk about the ideas that shape our world. I'm Ben Lima. Our guest today is Michael Lobel, professor of art history at Hunter College and the Graduate Center of the City University of New York. Along with many articles and catalog essays, he's the author of three books: Image Duplicator, Roy Lichtenstein and the Emergence of Pop Art; James Rosenquist, Pop Art, Politics, and History in the 1960s; and John Sloan, Drawing on Illustration, which won the Smithsonian American Art Museum's Charles C. Eldridge Prize for Distinguished Scholarship in American Art. And he's also the recipient of numerous grants and fellowships. And he's also on Twitter at @MLobelArt. Thanks for being with us today.
Thanks for having me, Ben.
I wanted to start by asking some sort of general questions. And I know that you are recently looking at realism, and I thought if someone takes Art History 101, they might learn that realism was a 19th century movement coming after Romanticism and before Impressionism, and then in the 20th century it sort of declined in favor of abstraction before briefly reappearing as photorealism in the 1970s. But in fact, it's much more interesting than that, and realism was a very significant style throughout the 20th century. I wondered if you could talk a little bit about realism in the 20th century, which most people probably don't know as much about.
Yeah. It's funny that you should ask me about this, because I've actually been talking a lot to a doctoral student at the Graduate Center, which is part of the City University of New York, about a possible dissertation topic around this sort of subject. And she and I have actually been talking a lot about the sort of, you know, the way you introduced the topic as saying that abstraction sort of took the limelight from realism in the 20th century. And I think that's true to a certain extent, but I also think what may be more accurate would be to say that certain critics and maybe artists also pushed a kind of narrative or story about abstraction being the reigning sort of mode for art in the 20th century. And I think particularly in the context of art in our own time, in the context of contemporary art, when we have major sort of, when I'm thinking particularly of major contemporary painters like Carrie James Marshall, Nicole Eisenman, Dana Schutz, that it may be time right now to kind of revisit and rework that history, or the kind of discourse or discussion about the relationship between abstraction and what we call figuration or realism in the 20th century, because there were always artists who were working with.
Would you say, I mean, from the perspective of the public, I mean, it seems like whether it's Andrew Wyeth or Norman Rockwell or Grant Wood, you know, who's on view now at the Whitney, I believe, the public at large always has seemed to be quite appreciative of their work, and it's more the kind of elite critics, as you mentioned, who rejected it for various reasons. I mean, did you think that kind of elite popular opposition is a kind of important to understand?
I think it is to some extent. I mean, I think it would be easy to overstate it.
Yeah.
You know, I think that there are plenty of dorm room posters of Mark Rothko or Jackson Pollock.
Yeah.
And I think there's a wide sort of interest in artists like Mondrian and Kandinsky.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But I do think to some extent, you know, there has been a kind of elite popular divide around some of these figures. And I think, again, these conversations I've been having with this particular graduate student and others around this, that oftentimes when sort of critics or art historians in our milieu, in sort of academia or the higher echelons of criticism, talk about 20th century realisms, it's very hard, or there's a kind of impulse to see those figures as politically conservative, as reactionary, which is true to some extent, but then there were plenty of figures who were using realism for leftist ends. I mean, I was just at the Modern in Fort Worth yesterday, and you know, looking at a Ben Shahn painting,
which I found
very interesting. So I think it's just a much more complicated story. I think, and I would not want to separate things out into elite versus popular, rather sort of think more about different modes of realism and how they were used and put to use both by artists and critics. Just to add to this a little bit or to expand on it a little bit, a few months ago I wrote a reflection in a series of pieces that the magazine Art in America put together after Linda Nochlin's death. Mm-hmm. And Linda Nochlin, as you know, was one of the great historians of art in the last half century and really arguably the founder of the field of feminist art history. And most people talked about her as a feminist art historian in this series of reflections. I talked about her as a scholar of realism and mm-hmm. realisms. And what's interesting about her career is that she was both a scholar, and you pointed this out earlier, she was a scholar of realism with a capital R mm-hmm. as a 19th century art movement, but that her study of historical realism was always tied to her interest, and this was particularly in the 1960s and 1970s, in contemporary mm-hmm. realist art or contemporary realisms.
Like Alice Neal and Alex Katz type.
Alice Neal, Sylvia Slay. And there were many feminist artists and women painters who embraced realism, again, not for conservative reactionary purposes, but, you know, for the purposes of their own feminist politics. So
I thought we could even kind of connect this to pop, because when pop art first emerged, it was sometimes seen as a kind of realism, and I believe the gallerist Sidney Janis actually categorizing several pop artists as so-called new realists. So my question would be, could pop art be seen as a kind of counterpart to realism, or has that sort of been left behind?
That is a good question. I mean, yes. So early on, a figure like Sidney Janis, in this famous early exhibition, grouped pop art with a group of European artists who had already been labeled new realists or nouveau realists. I wonder if he was sort of pushing the evidence of that a little bit to create something for his gallery and for the market. I would make a distinction between artists who are engaged in kind of figurative painting and pop art, because while pop did let figuration in and sort of subject matter back in, it's always marked, and I was saying this yesterday in my talk at the Modern, pop always marks its imagery as being always already reproduced. When you see a pop art painting, as a viewer, you're almost always recognizing that what you're looking at is something that has appeared elsewhere before, that was seen first in reproduction, and that's being represented or represented to you. Just to kind of put a finer point on it, I do think I would make a distinction between the way that imagery is treated by the pop artists, and by that I mean, you know, particularly American artists in the 1960s, even looking back, maybe a certain group of British artists in the 1950s. I think the subject matter and imagery they're treating is dealt with in a different way than figurative painters deal with it.
I was also thinking, in 2018, that our whole culture at this point seems so, I think you could say, so thoroughly pop, that it seems to take some real effort for, say, students to think back to 1960 and 61 to see how strange and unusual pop art appeared at that time. And I was wondering, how do you get across, to someone today, how unusual and new and shocking and weird these first efforts by Lichtenstein and Warhol appeared at that time, or did they?
You mean when I'm teaching or lecturing pop? Because how do I convey the newness?
I've had the experience in talking about pop that, you know, this idea of, you know, mass media and mass culture and entertainment, and it just seems, it's just sort of such second nature at this time that sometimes it can be hard for, say, students to get, well, what's the big deal? Why did this seem to surprise people? I'm just wondering if there's a way of kind of getting across how different it seemed back in 1960. I don't know if you had any thoughts on that.
I don't know exactly how to answer that, but the first thing that came to mind is something I almost always show my students. So an image I almost always put on the screen when I'm teaching students either about the work of Andy Warhol or about the emergence of pop art in the US art world in the early 1960s, which is, it's an image of a window display that Warhol created for the Bonwit-Teller department store in New York in, I think it was the spring of 1961. And what the image, the photograph shows is a series of mannequins dressed in the newest fashions. I think it might have been, now I'm not a fashion historian and I'm woefully uninclined to understand much about fashion, but I think they're probably in summer fashions because I think the window, Warhol created the window for Bonwit-Teller in the spring of that year, in the spring of 1961. We don't have to put that in, but in any case, in the window, there's a line of mannequins wearing sort of current fashions that are being put on display for the department store. And in back of them is a series of, I think it's like four or five canvases.
Uh-huh.
Now, in some ways, they were just there. You know, Warhol put them there as kind of visual information, right? But in fact, what those canvases are some of Andy Warhol's earliest attempts at experimenting with using commercial mass media printed imagery and including them in painted canvases.
Uh-huh.
And so there's something about that episode and that moment of this bringing together a collapse of the context of commercial display, right? Because, and a lot of people don't realize or understand or recognize that before Warhol became what we call a pop artist, before he started making paintings using commercial subject matter, he spent about a decade as a commercial artist in New York City, as a very successful fashion illustrator, as a successful sort of window display designer. And so that Bonwit-Teller window is like, it illustrates this collision between, or this collapse between Warhol's work up until that point as a commercial artist and illustrator and display artist, and his new attempts to use that experience and that imagery to make paintings.
Hmm.
So I love that photograph and I show it a lot because for me, it just condenses and encapsulates a moment where these two things that, I mean, what I would say to the students is that yes, commerce and popular culture had for a long time been a part of high art. I mean, we can go back, speaking of 19th century realism, we can go back to Gustave Courbet, who was looking at popular imagery. But in the second half of the 20th century, when pop art emerges, there's just a much more intense collapse or bringing together of those two things.
Yeah.
So that's, you know, if you ask me, you know, how do you explain it? I would, because I'm an art historian, because I started out as a studio artist, because I'm visually oriented, I usually try to explain things through images.
Yes.
So there's a little bit of a difficulty or impediment to us having this conversation just solely over audio,
right?
Because I want to show people, I want to show you or people who are listening this photograph of Warhol's display, Bonwateller window display, and then the paintings he included in it.
Yeah, that's that sounds so, I mean, so interesting. And I maybe this is just sort of my obsession, but you know, listening to that description, my thought is, wow, like a window display with canvases in it. You know, every single thing there is this material object, and I'm just mentally contrasting it with the experience of, again, you know, Twitter or Instagram or social media, and I'm thinking, like, when was the last time I saw a really neat window display? And it was certainly whenever the last time I was in New York City and happened to be walking down Fifth Avenue and they did it. But just the very idea of you know, carefully making these objects in a way that wasn't kind of looking over one's shoulder at digital media and so forth, seems like such a, it just seems like there's such a gap between daily experience now and that sort of thing. But that sounds like a really powerful example.
I mean, just to, if I may, expand on that a little bit.
Please, yeah.
I think one of the challenges, I mean, going back to your question about explaining pop to people and why it was radical, one of the challenges of teaching art history and teaching people about art in our time in 2018 is that we're so enmeshed in the digital world that we are oftentimes disconnected from the materiality of actual objects.
Yeah.
So I was at the Modern in Fort Worth yesterday looking really closely at their Andy Warhol Marilyn painting from 1962, which is a really important example of Warhol's early experiments with silk screening. And there are things that you learn or understand about Warhol's approach by standing in front of the painting, experiencing its scale, seeing things he did about color choices, seeing things he did about choosing how to screen the images that you don't really get in a digital image. So I know it's, I mean, and again, it's sort of funny that we're being recorded on audio when we don't, we don't even have digital images, you know, in front of us, but it's often a hard case to make to people to make them understand that examining things in person, like actual material objects, is important for doing this kind of work. But, and there are people who do, I think, what you and I do, who are less engaged with looking closely at material objects like paintings and sculptures and all forms of material culture. I personally and professionally am very invested in sort of close visual and material analysis. So,
and I'll just put in a little plug there that if you go to the website of the Modern Art Museum of Fort Worth, there will be recorded version of the amazing lecture that Michael gave yesterday, where he really shows how the kind of nuances of these paintings really come through when you're standing in front of them looking closely, and you just can't get those from the Instagram. Our guest today is Michael Lobel. We're going to take a short break, and when we come back, we'll talk more about Roy Lichtenstein and James Rosenquist.